Thanks for listening to the Best of Outkick the Coverage podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday morning from 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern, 3 to 6 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for Outkick the Coverage at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every morning on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR.
This is the Best of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis on Fox Sports Radio.
When people see this, they're going to say, well, he wasn't really a nice guy. He may have been a tyrant. Oh, well, that's you, because you never won anything. I wanted to win, but I wanted them to win and be a part of that as well. Like, I don't have to do this. I'm only doing it because it is who I am. That's how I played the game. That was my mentality. If you don't want to play that way, don't play that way.
That was Michael Jordan, episode 7 at the end of The Last Dance, and I thought it went right to the essence of the Michael Jordan sort of ethos. Appreciate all of you hanging out with us. I hope you had a great weekend. We're going to be talking a lot about The Last Dance. We'll be talking in hour 3 about the UFC event, maybe even a little bit before that. On the UFC event, but as we have for the past 3 Mondays, now make it the 4th Monday in a row, The Last Dance, the Michael Jordan Chicago Bulls documentary, will dominate the program. And before we get into The Last Dance here, pretty quickly, I want to share some optimism with you based on the data that is out there. You just heard from Eddie Garcia, as he said, that Major League Baseball is getting closer and closer to the return of its sport. And I believe we are going to have baseball sooner rather than later, meaning by early July, based on the trend lines that we are headed, which is a very positive thing. I hope all of you, by the way, out there had great Mother's Day on Sundays. Thanks to all the moms out there for all that you do. On a day-to-day basis, including my own mom, my mother-in-law's, and importantly, my own wife. But there was a lot of Mother's Day United States coronavirus positivity, and I'm going to hit you with 3 different data points, which are all really significant, and let you know that sports is going to be back, if you don't count the UFC, if you don't count NASCAR, if you don't count PGA, sooner rather than later. First of all, we had the fewest deaths in this country since March 29th, all right? The fewest deaths in the country from the coronavirus since March the 29th. We had the lowest, this is on Sunday, Mother's Day, we had the lowest daily positive percentage for all the coronavirus tests at just under 8% positive since testing began in this country. We're also testing right now around 300,000 people a day. And by the way, the goal is to reopen the country around a 10% positivity rate. So for the national number, we are now underneath where the goal would be to open up the entire country. And we had the fewest positive new daily cases since March 29th. As well. So here we are sitting at Monday, May the 11th, and we had the best numbers in whatever the math is on that. 2 plus 12, 13, you guys all know how dangerous, in 43 days. The best numbers in this country in 43 days in terms of the overall data points. Why does this matter? Well, it points towards a return to normalcy sooner rather than later. Some other data points that I think are significant. Georgia, which opened up its state way back on, if you remember, April 24th, and everybody said, oh my God, Georgia's going to be just a disaster. It has now been over 2 weeks. We are now 17 days since the state of Georgia opened, and everything's kind of been fine. The state of Tennessee opened around 2 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago today, and everything in the state of Tennessee has been fine. The state of Florida is opening up. I'm in Florida right now doing my program. You have the ability to go out starting today and get your hair cut, get your nails done, get the spa treatments that you all dream of. A lot of that stuff, I've never been in a spa, so I don't really know what happens there. But I know it's open now. And so we have got the state of Florida opening up in a big way. Texas, Oklahoma, none of the places that are opening up, at least so far, have seen any kind of spike in infections or deaths like the quote-unquote experts predicted was likely to be the case. We are rapidly getting better in this country, even if most in the media are not sharing those facts with you. I have tried to share those facts with you from the get-go. Not saying I've been perfect. You guys know I'm not perfect. I'm an imperfect person. But I try to trust you with the actual facts on a day-to-day basis surrounding the coronavirus since it has now been, I believe, 2 months exactly since Rudy Gobert tested positive. I believe in the near future, probably this week, we are going to hear a plan for Major League Baseball to come back around July 1st. I'm hearing that a lot of people are thinking, hey, you know what would be incredible? What if Major League Baseball came back on July 4th and they had a Stars and Stripes spectacular in this country for July 4th? That's at least an idea that I have heard floated out there by some people in the know who I trust when it comes to breaking down all of the data. All of that I just hit you with, 100% accurate. The most recent data, when you are being terrified, when people are telling you there's no light at the end of the tunnel, there is very much a light at the end of the tunnel, and it ain't a train about to run you over either. We are handling this thing, and things are getting better on a rapid basis. And by the way, you look at the data of where the danger is coming from at this point from the coronavirus, two different analyses of the data between 33 and 40%, according to two different investigations, of all the deaths from the coronavirus have come out of nursing homes. Between 33 and 40% of all the deaths from nursing homes. We need to protect nursing homes, the most vulnerable people. But if you are young and healthy, we need you to go back to work because over 33 million people have lost their jobs, and it's time to get this economy back on its footing to take care of everybody out there who is going to have substantial health impacts from an economic downturn as much or more than they are from the actual coronavirus. So that is all the big takeaways of the big picture coming out of the weekend. But man, let's dive back into The Last Dance. You heard that audio from Michael Jordan. And I would say in general, episode 7 was a lot about James Jordan, his dad, and how tragic that that death was from James Jordan. For those of you who didn't remember what a huge story it was, the Michael Jordan decision as he mourned his father to walk away from basketball and decide to play baseball. Jordan said at the age of 31, he and his dad were debating him playing baseball. His dad was saying to do it. He went and he played for the Birmingham Barons, a double-A team, and immediately began his career in baseball with a 13-game hitting streak. Then they said he got all breaking balls from that point forward and started to have a lot of difficulty. But while very few people remember the Jordan era in baseball that well, that season he hit 202 and drove in 50 runs. And Terry Francona, who was his manager, said if he had gotten 1,500 at-bats, he'd have gone to Major League Baseball. And I went and watched Michael Jordan play minor league baseball as a kid growing up in Nashville, Tennessee. We had a stadium, minor league baseball stadium at the time, Greer Stadium. And that season, they had a double and a triple A team both playing in Nashville. And I remember very well Michael Jordan coming to play in Nashville because we were sitting in the right field bleachers. Jordan was playing right field. And that entire stadium was electric. I have been fortunate enough to go to World Series before. I went and watched the Dodgers play just a couple of years ago out in Chavez Ravine. And the atmosphere when Michael Jordan was playing minor league baseball was electric, like the atmosphere at the World Series. The biggest game you can possibly imagine. That's the kind of excitement that Michael Jordan brought to bear as he went around to all these double-A baseball stadiums. They said he put him in double-A so that he could handle the media onrush. And Jordan was forever furious after SI said, "Bag it, Michael." But what he did while playing baseball electrified so much of the country and spoke to his overall appeal and how desperate people were to just be in his presence, how electric and just amazingly potent it was when Michael Jordan was in the building. Everybody said, you know, it's a famous cliche now, Elvis has left the building. But when Michael Jordan was there, you could feel it. And Jordan, it's interesting to think about, what would he have done if there hadn't been a baseball strike in 1995? We may never know, but he decided to come back and play. And in 1995, as we followed along in the documentary against Horace Grant and the Orlando Magic, Jordan tried to steal a title, but he wasn't quite there. Although the talent was so amazing that a lot of people, when he came back, were saying, "Hey, how good is this guy going to be?" And he dropped 55 in Madison Square Garden in his fifth game back. And also, I thought so much of the discussion point in this documentary was about Jordan's ability to find motivation. Whether it was Sports Illustrated saying, "Bag it, Michael," and never speaking to SI again, whether it was BJ Armstrong going off in game two of their series back in, I think it was 1998, whether it was LaBradford Smith, a guy who scored 37 points in Chicago, and Michael Jordan said that he told him, "Nice game, Mike," after the game. And then Jordan went out and scored 36 in the first half. Later on, Jordan said, "I made it up." I would love to have heard, by the way, from LaBradford Smith if they could have found him back. Nick Anderson said 45's not 23 and stripped him at the end of game one as Jordan was trying to get back into shape. And then Jordan brings back the number 23. How about the punching incident with Steve Kerr, which we've heard so much about on both sides, and the way Jordan responded to it, which we'll talk about. But in the finals, when George Karl didn't say hi to Jordan and how that got him fired up, and then that incredible audio. Do we have that audio of Jordan watching the video of Gary Payton saying, "Hey, if I'd been put on Michael Jordan earlier, maybe it would have made a difference." And then Jordan saying, quote, "I had no problem with the glove," after laughing for a long time. Let's play that audio for you if you didn't hear it last night.
"A lot of people back down the bike. I didn't. I made it a point. I said, just tire him out. You just got to tire him out. And I kept hitting him and banging him and hitting him and banging him. It took a toll on Mike. It took a toll, and then I feel myself resting him a little bit, and then the series changed. And I wish I could have did it earlier. I don't know if the outcome would have been different, but it was a difference and beating him down a little bit."
The glove. "I had no problem with the glove. I had no problem with Gary Payton. I had a lot of other things on my mind."
And then that was Jordan leading into Father's Day and thinking about his dad and the fact that he hadn't been there to watch him. I also thought another huge part of the discussion was Michael Jordan punching Steve Kerr. Do we have audio about the Jordan Steve Kerr discussion, Danny G? This has been much ballyhooed, much talked about quite a bit, was the relationship between Michael Jordan and his teammates. In particular, I loved when they asked B.J. Armstrong, was he a nice guy? I don't know if we have that audio, but I thought it was so incredibly telling, and that Jordan, BJ Armstrong paused for a long time as he analyzed Michael Jordan, and they were led into all those incredible quotes. But we also had the quote from Will Perdue, who said he was an a-hole, he was a jerk, he crossed the line numerous times, but then that all led to the ability to also win when it came to the crucible moment. But as Jordan was coming back and getting back into shape in the preseason, in the season that the Bulls would go 72-10, set the record at the time for the greatest team of all time, and then go on to also win the title, something that obviously the Golden State Warriors could not do, Jordan punched Steve Kerr. Here's that story.
Phil put Steve Kerr guarding me.
We were on opposite sides in a scrimmage, and he's talking all kinds of trash, and I'm pissed because, you know, we're getting our ass kicked.
Phil sensed my aggression, but he was trying to tone me down, and he starts calling these tic-tac fouls. Now, I'm getting mad because for you to be protecting this guy, that's not going to help us when we play New York. It's not going to help us when we play these teams that are very physical. Next time he did it, I just haul off. I said, when I fouled Steve Kerr, I said, now that's a foul.
I have a lot of patience as a human being, but I tend to snap at some point because I'm extremely competitive too. Just not really good enough to back it up usually. But I'm going. I'm going. I'm gonna fight.
He hauls off and hits me in the chest. And I just haul off and hit him right in the And Phil just throws me out of practice.
That is Jordan saying he got thrown out of practice. But what was interesting is, and we don't have the audio, I guess, is what happened after that. Because as often happens, and this is what I think makes men unique, two men can fight and end up really good friends. I don't know that that happens with women, right? There are probably guys out there in your life that at some point you hated, and then you ended up having some sort of altercation. It doesn't necessarily have to be physical, but where both of you kind of confronted each other and went head to head, and then you end up respecting each other more. In fact, Jordan said, and I quote, he earned my respect, because Jordan said he requested Steve Kerr's cell phone number or phone number or whatever and called him and apologized. And then he said, from that point, our relationship dramatically improved. And Jordan felt, he said, bad, because Steve Kerr's not a big guy. He went after one of the smallest guys on the team and got so angry at him that he punched him in the face. But he then called Steve Kerr and apologized, said he earned my respect. From that point, our relationship dramatically improved. We're going to unpack all this. I'll bring in the crew. We are breaking down The Last Dance, episodes 7 and 8, Michael Jordan and the Bulls, the documentary that is airing every Sunday night on ESPN. We're also going to talk about the UFC. We have got a lot to unpack as we move through today's program.
This is Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis.
Let me go ahead and bring in Eddie Garcia and get the update while it's time here. Eddie, what you got for me?
Well, let's start with news from Major League Baseball, where the league and its owners are going to hold a conference call later today. And in basketball news, according to court documents in a civil lawsuit, the former marketing agency for ex-Duke star, current Pelicans rookie Zion Williamson alleged his family took money to steer him to Duke and certain shoe companies. This could lead to an NCAA investigation. Now back to Clay Travis in the Geico Outkick the Coverage studios.
I read that Zion story, by the way, coming out of the lawsuit. I don't think anybody cares about players being paid anymore. I really don't. I mean, I think the average person who's out there listening to me right now, I think the NCAA has almost lost the ability to investigate players getting paid. I really do. I feel like that ship has sailed. I don't even think, you know, Kentucky fans care very much about Duke paying Zion Williamson. I think maybe Louisville fans do, because they're like the only program in America that seems to get slammed these days by the NCAA. But basketball powers, I think they're all doing the same thing. If you've been paying attention to this thing at all, everybody who has really high-end basketball players is in some way either paying them or facilitating their relationship with shoe companies. I think almost unanimously across the board, if you watch the documentary on HBO, if you've paid attention at all to these lawsuits and these investigations, Nike and Adidas and Under Armour, all of the shoe companies that had any money to spend at all were all competing aggressively to try to get the best talent. And the reason why they were all competing aggressively to try to get the best talent is because of the difference that having the best talent can bring to bear. I thought probably from a business perspective, the most interesting part of the Michael Jordan documentary that we've seen by far was how he ended up signing with Nike and the fact that he wanted to sign with Adidas, and that both Adidas and Converse blew it when it came to signing Air Jordan. If they had just given him the value that Nike did, then the entire sneaker industry would look completely different, because Jordan remade Nike and branded them with his particular patina of coolness. We're talking about the documentary that aired last night. There's a couple of other different things. The difference between Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen, to me, came through in a big way here as well. Sort of the difference between hot and cold, fire and ice. Jordan was the fire, and Pippen was the guy that everybody liked. Sort of, if you've ever played a sport, there tends to be, if there's a tough basketball coach, there tends to be a guy who comes in after the tough basketball coach and kind of puts his arm around you and is the nice guy to the bad guy that the head coach might at times have to pretend to be. And what I kept coming back to again and again was that Scottie needed Michael in order to truly get the most for his out of his ability. And I think that everybody did. And there was an interesting study that found, I know we live in this era now where everybody has to be nice and you're not supposed to be mean in sports and everything else. It turns out that getting yelled at by your coach, they've proven statistically, leads to better performances. Now, everybody's got a coach in their own way, but getting yelled at, they did an interesting study and examined the way that halftime speeches were experienced and then the impact after halftime. When a coach yelled the most at his team and got the angriest at them, they tended to play better. And it is not always the case, right? Everybody is different. But I feel like Michael Jordan was very much about tough love. And I see a lot of Jordan in his behavior in highly successful people. And the line that I thought stood out to Michael Jordan was somebody, Jordan said of himself, he never asked me to do something that he didn't effing do. And I believe if you think about Tom Brady or Peyton Manning or Michael Jordan or any of the truly greats that have helped to define success, the thing that frustrates them is not only that everybody else can't do what they do, and it's why the Michael Jordans of the world typically are not good coaches, it's that people aren't willing to do what they did to be great. And let me take it out of the world of basketball right now, and I'll give you an example in my own life. There are people who I have invited on this show in our industry that have said, and this has happened a bunch of different times, so I'm not trying to put somebody on blast, I can't do that, I'm on vacation that week. And we have a huge audience, right? We're one of the five biggest sports talk radio shows in the entire country, period. So if you are a young guy or girl and you get the opportunity to come on this show, you should, in my opinion, do whatever it takes to get on this show, because that's how you help to make a name for yourself. And I'm not saying that trying to be cocky about this show. I'm saying it because that's what I did for a decade. The way I got into radio was through writing. If I wrote an article and I got invited on the radio to talk about my article, it didn't matter where in the country, it didn't matter where in the world, I would go on and I would do it. I still, to this day, try and make things happen in terms of doing local radio. I went on in Iceland a couple of weeks ago. I'm going on in Australia this week. I've done Korea. This is me right now being quote-unquote successful. I can't stop doing what made me successful. People say, Don Martin is my boss, at the head of Fox Sports Radio. He said before, man, you should just be enjoying all the success that your show is having, that you're having in your career. And I can't do that. I mean, I'm a very happy person. I think I'm relatively well adjusted, but I don't sit back and enjoy anything that I've accomplished because I'm constantly thinking I've got to keep working, right? I'm a grinder, for better or worse. And when I see a guy like Jordan and they talk about how hard he worked, I appreciate that. I appreciate things when people control what they can control, right? When you are working as hard as you possibly can, that I appreciate. And so I'll hear people, like I'll reach out and I'll be like, hey, can you come on? They're like, I'm on vacation. Like, what? You know, if I got a call from Dan Patrick to come on his show before I did national radio, it wouldn't matter where I was in the world and what I was doing. I would find a way to do that 15-minute hit. If Colin Cowherd, before I even knew Colin Cowherd, invited me on his radio program, I would do whatever under the sun it would take to get on his radio program. Accept opportunity when it's there. And sometimes now I get frustrated when I see people not willing to do the things that I do in order to be successful. Like I used to pick on Jason Martin, who is the fill-in host and was the producer on this show. But I expect if I get a text asking me about something at work and I have like 15 jobs, but if somebody in TV texts me, I almost immediately get back to them. If it's something that needs to be gotten back to, I expect almost immediate reaction from text when I'm like, hey, is this going on? And I really don't care what time. And that might be tough, but when you work all day long, every day, like I do, you presume that everybody else is going to be the same. And I've had to kind of, in my head, deal with the fact that everybody else is not like me. I believe the reason why I've been successful and the reason why most people out there, regardless of what profession you embrace, are successful is because they work harder than other people. I really 100% believe that. In order to be truly, truly good, you have to work harder than other people. It's the only thing you can control. You can't control the opportunities that you're going to get. You can't control what's going on in the surrounding area. All you can control is how hard you work. And that's what I love about Jordan. And that's, I think, also the disconnect between he and somebody like Scottie Pippen. Jordan would have never refused to go into a basketball game at the end of the game. Now, you can argue, well, Jordan would have had the ball in his hand at all times as well. But that subplot of Scottie Pippen staying on the bench and of Bill Cartwright crying and Scottie Pippen crying too and apologizing to the team, Jordan calling Phil Jackson and saying, I don't know if Scottie's ever going to live this down. And then 20 years later, over 20 years later, or whatever it is, 25 years later, Scottie Pippen had a chance to say, yeah, you know what? I blew it there, because Tony Kukoc comes in, hits the shot, keeps that series alive that goes to 7 games that the Bulls almost won in the semifinals the year that Jordan set out the full season. And instead, Scottie Pippen reinforces the fact that if he had to do it all over again, he would do the exact same thing. It's just, it was to me, people talked about how this documentary might reflect poorly on Michael Jordan. I think Michael Jordan is basically winning his seventh NBA championship this year. That's how much this is working in his favor. He's branding himself for an entirely new generation of sports fans, even though his shoe sells better than every current player that exists in the league right now. But I think Scottie Pippen is the guy who is coming off looking the worst. We'll talk about that when we come back.
This is Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis.
I hope all of you are having fantastic starts to your week, Monday edition of the program. I am down in Florida, still going to be down here until Memorial Day as we continue to roll you through the offseason. Big news, I would say, in general from the world of sports over the weekend, the UFC gets their event done. Wildly popular. Huge number of people out there who are consuming the UFC content. This weekend, NASCAR comes back. In the next couple of weeks, we're going to have the PGA going with different events that are not official PGA events, but by June 11th, the PGA is going to be back. I am hearing, you just heard Eddie Garcia give you an update on Major League Baseball. I am hearing that Major League Baseball is going to be back around July 4th if they can get this deal hammered out between the players and the owners as to what the league might look like. And as they continue to move forward, the data out there is getting better and better from the coronavirus, despite the fact that if you put on the news, you probably wouldn't know it. And let me share that data with you as I try to do and have tried to do over the past 2 months since Rudy Gobert came off the court. Yesterday was Mother's Day. Thanks to all the mothers out there. But we had the fewest deaths in this country from the coronavirus at 750 since March 29th. The lowest daily positive percentage for coronavirus testing at just under 8% since testing began for the coronavirus. The fewest positive new daily cases at 20,329 going all the way back to March 29th as well. Now, these are Sunday numbers, and as the Corona bros among us would like to say, well, the numbers go down sometimes on the weekend, and that can be true because they're reporting lags and whatnot, but we haven't ever seen the numbers this low going all the way back to March 29th, and there are a bunch of Sundays in there as well, and the overall trend lines and trajectories of this coronavirus outbreak continue to look better and better, especially with the states that have opened up. Georgia, Florida, Tennessee, Texas, Oklahoma. A lot of these states you heard, oh, when they open up, the number of cases are going to explode. Well, it's now been 17 days since the state of Georgia opened up. It's now been 2 weeks since the state of Tennessee opened, Texas as well, Florida, opening up haircut places and salons to get your nails done, everything else. Lots of places in the South in particular returning completely to normal. I'm down on the Gulf Coast in Florida. You would not know that there had ever been a coronavirus outbreak, hardly at all, if you're walking around the part of the country that I am in right now. Mother's Day, all the restaurants are open. All of the retail stores are open. Everything feels very, very normal down here in Florida, in the part of the country that I am in right now. So I think all of those things are moving in the direction of positivity. But we are breaking down The Last Dance, episodes 7 and 8 with Michael Jordan. And I'm not sure if the NBA is going to come back. I think Major League Baseball is going to come back. I think hockey probably will find a way back. I think MLS is going to come back. I think it's possible the NBA is the only league that doesn't come back. And if that happens, I still think the NBA is more likely than not to come back. But if the NBA doesn't come back, you might as well go ahead and give Michael Jordan a seventh title. Because I believe what basketball fans are going to remember is this 10-part documentary it's as if Jordan is winning another NBA title with the way that he is coming off in this documentary. He was concerned that people were going to hate him. I think that Jordan is becoming beloved for an entirely new generation of people that might not know him otherwise. And that's where I want to open up the phone lines and allow you guys to react. I only want people out there, as you were starting off your morning, to call in if you don't remember Michael Jordan on the court yourself because you were too young. 877-996-6369. And if so, I understand you might have seen Jordan play in YouTube. You might have seen an old ESPN classic version of one of his games. But I'm curious what you guys think. You are theoretically the LeBron generation, i.e., you have grown up with LeBron James, and you've heard these debates about Jordan versus LeBron your entire life, but you're not able to actually debate it because you haven't seen both guys actually play in their prime. What is your impression of Michael Jordan, and how has that impression changed based on these eight episodes so far? 877-996-6369. Dub, you are of this generation. You are young, too young to remember Jordan playing yourself. How have your impressions, if at all, changed on Jordan as you've watched this documentary?
Well, obviously, like you said, in that generation, I've gone back throughout my youth and whatnot and watched YouTube videos and stuff. But I mean, I didn't really know many of the backstories behind everything. You know, I knew his father was murdered. I didn't really know much about it. I had no idea about the Scottie Pippen sitting on the bench, refusing to come in the final seconds. There's just so many things I don't know and didn't know that I'm getting to finally see with this documentary. And I mean, Michael Jordan, I mean, I've been hearing people say all my life, you know, he was different. He was different. He was just a different level than anything you see today or even back then. And this just kind of confirms all those statements that I've heard, you know, throughout the years of my life.
Well, I'll let you field calls because I am curious from young guys and girls out there who may be watching this documentary that never saw Jordan play. What do you think about the argument that this is like Jordan winning a seventh title, especially if the NBA doesn't come back? To me, I don't even hardly think in the wake of this 10-episode documentary that there's hardly going to be anybody able to argue that Michael Jordan isn't better than LeBron James in the context of this documentary is making him a legend. Playing sports can make you famous. The way people talk about you playing sports makes you a legend. It wasn't the shootout at the OK Corral that made Wyatt Earp a legend. It was everybody talking about, for the ensuing generations, the shootout at the OK Corral that made Wyatt Earp a legend. You may, as you recognize greatness, want to be able to say, oh, I went and I watched this athlete play. Like, there are still people alive in this country today who will talk about the fact that they have seen Babe Ruth play or Lou Gehrig play. Legendary Yankee players. That it's almost unbelievable to think about real flesh and blood player on the field, and there's a dwindling number of people out there who can say, as kids, I went to go watch Babe Ruth play. There's a whole generation of people that are never going to have watched Michael Jordan play, but this documentary is creating the legend of Michael Jordan in everyone's mind. And especially if the NBA doesn't come back, I think Jordan is branding himself as the guy for the future. And that, to me, is one of the most intriguing parts of this documentary. 877-996-6369. And I think it can be challenging for people like me. I'm 41. I already have my impressions of Jordan. Unlike Dub, I actually know all these stories. It's fun for me to go back and re-experience them nostalgically. But my 12 and my 9-year-old, they don't really know Jordan. And so the way they're watching this documentary, he is a legend to them. We got some young callers who want to weigh in. You can as well. 877-996-6369. I don't want you guys who are around my age. I only want people calling in who don't remember watching a Michael Jordan game themselves to get their impression on this documentary. Who's up first, Dub?
We got Max in Indiana.
Max, how would you characterize the documentary?
Well, I was born in 94, so I definitely, only Michael Jordan I remember is the Wizards, Michael Jordan, so that's not very good.
Yes.
But I used to think LeBron James, nobody could compete with him, but I grew up about an hour away from where Larry Bird grew up, and whenever he said Michael Jordan was, he wasn't Michael Jordan, he was God disguised as him, that's whenever I knew nobody could touch that guy. I mean,
So thanks for calling in. So you would prior to this documentary, because you were born in 1994, you would have argued LeBron was better than Michael Jordan if we'd had a debate. And after watching 8 episodes of this documentary, you now are on the Michael Jordan is better than LeBron James train.
I would still take Kobe Bryant in a 1-on-1 over LeBron James, but basketball player on the court, yeah, I thought LeBron James was the best thing that could have happened until this. And, there's no questions asked. Scoring 40 points every playoff game against Larry Bird, Michael Jordan, or Magic Johnson, that's no joke. And nobody could touch that now. It was awesome. Hey, thanks for the call. I got to go to work, but awesome show. Big fan. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Dub, who's up next?
We got Brandon in Salt Lake City.
Brandon, how old are you?
Hey, I'm 18 years old. I just graduated high school last year, so I was born in 2001. I appreciate you taking my call. I never saw Michael Jordan play, and I've been in this LeBron era, but I remember my dad always talking about the shot where he in Game 6 where he sent the Jazz home pretty much.
Yes.
And I never understood why my dad was always like, oh, yeah, Michael Jordan's the best. I'm like, have you seen LeBron? I mean, he's huge. He's, helping out his teammates. Like, I never understood. My dad always told me it's the way in which he won, the way in which, he scored the ball and took over games. And I never understood that until this documentary came out.
Thanks for the call. So, by the way, are you of the opinion now that you think Jordan is better than LeBron since the documentary?
Oh, yes. Yes, 100%. I went out and bought a Jordan jersey just like last week. I was like, this guy has just changed my whole perspective on what, the game was back in the 90s. I never, got the vibe of what it was before.
Yeah, thanks for the call. It's interesting because the market is responding. And as we go to break here, I want only young callers, okay? Only people to call into the show right now who have never, ever watched a live Michael Jordan Chicago Bulls game that you can remember, right? You might have been 1 or 2 or 3 years old running around in your house while your parents were watching. How, if at all, has this changed your impression of what is one of the longest running arguments in sports, Michael Jordan compared to LeBron James for who is the best of all time? How, if at all, has this changed your impression? There are several legendary cards, sports cards, memorabilia. In 1986-87 Fleer rookie card for Michael Jordan, it's doubled in value since this documentary began. I have that card. I don't know about you guys, but my generation, we were obsessed with, a lot of us were anyway, baseball cards. And if you were around my age, and again, I'm 41, in the 90s, baseball card collecting shows were a big deal. You could go out, you could walk around, all the baseball card collectors would have their wares out for you to be able to buy. One of the things that I got when I was old enough to get it was the Michael Jordan 86-87 rookie card. I paid $400 for it. I've still got it, and it was for a long time in a safe deposit box because I was like, man, this thing's going to end up really valuable. Some of them are selling now for over $50,000 each. Now, it's partly what the card is rated in terms of how perfect the card is, but those values, and I don't even know, frankly, what my card would rate at. I'm excited to get back home to Nashville to pull it out and take a picture of it and put it on social media so all of the card experts can grade it. I don't want to sell it. But I paid $400 for that card because when I was a kid growing up, people like my dad would say, oh, I used to have Mickey Mantle's rookie card. And Mickey Mantle's rookie card became such an iconic part of the overall branding of that era that card's worth like over $50,000 now itself. Well, this Jordan 86-87 rookie card, which is rare, there aren't that many of them, has doubled in value since this documentary began. Tons of people out there who may not have been aware of it otherwise are now falling in love with Michael Jordan either more than they already were or for the first time ever. I know I said we're going to go to break, but I think, Dub, we got a couple more younger callers who want to weigh in.
Yeah, that's right. We got Jacob in Georgia.
Jacob, how old are you?
Hey, Clay, I'm 27. I'm here in Warner Robins, Georgia, hometown of Jake Fromm.
Yeah. All right. Well, so 27, you don't remember watching Jordan play. It's crazy because there's a lot of people out there who are around my age and you don't really do the math. And you're like 27. You're not that young of a dude, but you don't even at 27. You don't remember watching Jordan play for the Bulls at all.
No, I was about 6 years old when he won his last championship. And I mainly remember him from Space Jam. I didn't know he played baseball until I watched Space Jam. And then,
yeah.
You know, growing up, first, second grade, I took my school yearbook pictures with his jersey, and my parents loved him. So, man, honestly, I just got done watching the seventh episode last night, and his competitiveness is what is really sticking out to me and just makes me love him even more.
So were you a LeBron is the greatest of all time guy, or were you a Jordan guy before, even though you never watched him play?
Honestly, I was Kobe.
Okay.
Until I really dove into this.
So right now you would say that since you started watching this documentary, you would now say Jordan is the greatest in your mind.
100%.
Yeah. Thanks for the call. Thanks for listening. He was breaking up there a little bit with us. Who's up next, Dub?
We got Tom in New York.
Tom, how old are you?
I'm 26, Clay.
All right. So 26. You've been watching this documentary. Has your impression of who the greatest basketball player of all time is changed based on the documentary?
So I was a huge LeBron guy my whole life. I thought he was the greatest ever. And I don't necessarily think that's different now, but the competitiveness that Michael Jordan showed is just incredible. Like, there's no one else like him. He was the most competitive player ever, and I didn't realize that until I started watching the documentary.
So when you were a younger guy and you hear older guys, your dad, your grandpa, your uncles, whoever it is, sitting around talking about basketball, you maybe roll your eyes when they would talk about Michael Jordan, and now you've watched this documentary and yourself, you're like, oh, I get what they were talking about in a way that I didn't before this film came out.
Oh, absolutely. Me and my father-in-law have had this discussion like 100 times, and I've, like you said, I rolled my eyes, and it's just kind of like, it was like urban legend to me. And now you see how competitive he was.
Yeah. Thanks for the call. Okay, we're going to go to break. I want only young OutKick listeners right now, people who have never watched Jordan play themselves or don't remember it because they were so young when he played for the Bulls.
Be sure to catch live editions of OutKick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
We are joined now by Kevin Ioli. He is a UFC MMA writer for Yahoo Sports. Kevin, thanks for getting up early with us. Were you down in Jacksonville, or where did you, or how did you cover this?
I did it at home, Clay. I watched on television. They had WebEx conferences set up with the fighters, so it was actually just about like being there. It was a different experience than being ringside with a bunch of crazy people, but what a great show they had.
They did have a great show, and it seemed like it came off really well. If you were analyzing this from Dana White's perspective, obviously you had one fighter who tested positive out of the 24 fighters, I believe, who were tested. That did not go perfectly, but also not crazy given the number of people they were testing that somebody might test positive. What letter grade would you give the UFC, based on what we know right now this Monday morning, on their Saturday fight card?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd probably say, say a B plus, because they did have the three positive tests, the two cornermen and the fighter. And I think the problem that they had with that was the fact that they knew on Wednesday when he got there that he had a family member who was positive, and they let him kind of move around. They let him go to the weigh-in and show up. There was no need for him to take pictures, right? And I think if he was there with the commission, weighed in, and then, gone back to his room, it might have been a different story where, now there's a possibility that he infected others. We don't know that, but, that they increased the possibility. But I think overall they did good. I talked to Dana after the show, and he said to me that, he goes, I thought we did good, but we'll be better on Wednesday, and we'll be even better than that on Saturday. He said they're learning from each show that they do and learning from each day that goes by from their procedure. So, I thought overall they did pretty good.
How would you assess the importance of the UFC getting back first based on Dana White's perspective? This seemed to be a big point, an important thing for him to try to get America back to a sense of normalcy in terms of being first, right?
Right. Well, number one, he's friends with President Trump. Number two, it's his personality. Dana's the kind of guy, he wants to do everything, and, he's going to solve problems, and he looks at things as challenges. And so, I think some people have criticized him, and, he said, hey, it's not that I don't believe that this virus is a serious thing, but I believe that we can't just, hide from it. And so his feeling was, let's go out, let's try to put it on as safely as we can, take all the precautions we can and put the event on. I got to get my business up and going. They had lost tens of millions of dollars in the 2 months between their last show and this show, just in live gates and things like that. So, and they're going to continue to lose those live gates, but at least now they're going to get their TV money and have that back on. And the fighters who this is where you feel really bad, Clay. People don't think about this, but there were fighters who were training when this thing started, and they're independent contractors. They don't get paid unless they fight, and it costs them money in training camp. They bring in people, they get gyms, all the stuff that they do. And so by putting the show on, he was able to get the fighters paid, and so that was another good thing. These fighters earned paydays that they hadn't had, and they were in the hole because of their training camps.
Yeah, there's no doubt at all about that. We're talking to Kevin Ioli. The precedent that I thought was important to set was, one, get back and do it. Two, if a guy tests positive, you don't immediately have to quarantine everybody. I know that Dana White said, we thought this might happen when you're testing this many people.
Right.
Do you think they were truly shocked that somebody tests positive? Well, I know they hoped that nobody would. Or do you think they really kind of expected that this might happen, and so they really never gave any thought at all to anything other than having the fights?
Yeah, I mean, they thought that somebody could test positive. They knew that this was a possibility. They figured, the virus was still, actually cases were still going up in Florida when they went down there. So, they knew that the possibility existed. But what they wanted to do was they wanted to set up protocols that limited the possibility that if somebody did test positive, that they would have any bigger problem than just that person and the people that he was immediately in contact with. And I think for the most part, they did good. What we're really have to see is in 2 weeks, does anybody else pop up that, that you can directly relate to Jacare Sosa? That's the big issue. But I think, that it looks like everybody did well so far. And, I think that they took all the they had a lot of smart people working on it. They took all the precautions that they could possibly take. You know, they didn't enforce everything perfectly. You know, the one video of Jacare that came out with Fabricio Werdum, you know, that showed that they weren't, you know, even though the UFC put out a statement that they were following social distancing, they weren't doing that. You know, those two fighters weren't. But by and large, I thought they did really well.
Okay, what actually happened in the fights from a significant UFC perspective? And obviously, a lot of our audience was watching, but also, you know this, there's a huge hardcore UFC fan, and then there's a generalized UFC fan. And I thought there were a lot of generalized sports fans who were just desperate for the return of sports that wanted to watch this. What was the big takeaway from your perspective from these fights?
Well, I thought it was a spectacular night of fights, and I thought, you know, when you look at it, number one, Justin Gaethje, oh my God. I mean, Justin Gaethje has been one of the better fighters in the world, but he hasn't been at that elite level because he was kind of a reckless fighter. You know, he was a guy that in the past, you know, would, if he was going downhill on a black ice road, he would go 80 miles an hour, right? He just, you know, was trying to get where he was going so fast, and he would run into problems, and the two losses that he was 21-2 going in. The two losses he had were fights he probably could have won, but the way he fought. This time he fought an almost perfect fight against an amazingly tough fighter in Tony Ferguson. Justin Gaethje fought so smart. You know, he was under control. He fought with patience, and yet he was aggressive. You know, that, and it sounds like an oxymoron, but that if you know Justin Gaethje, the kind of fighter he is, that's exactly what he did. In fact, one point in the third round, you know, he hit Ferguson with a hook, and Ferguson kind of wobbled back to the cage. The old Gaethje would have gone charging in and might have gotten hit with a knee. This time, Gaethje stood there and he just kind of made sure, hey, I'm going to just keep breaking him down. And I thought that's the most significant thing. We were looking at a new star being born because this guy is a charismatic person. He does social work. He has a degree in social work, a really smart kid. And he has been in the UFC now for 7 fights and he's gotten 9 post-fight bonuses, including 5 fight of the nights. So he's the kind of guy that, you know, people are going to want to watch, and he's got the kind of personality to go with it. So I think that, you know, the development of Justin Gaethje was the biggest thing to me on Saturday night.
We're talking to Kevin Ioli at Kevin I on Twitter. Appreciate him getting up early. What is going forward now for the UFC? You mentioned Wednesday, Saturday. How many more events are scheduled right now? Will they all take place in Jacksonville?
Yeah, they have 2 more in Jacksonville, Wednesday and Saturday, and then the 23rd, they have a show scheduled. But we don't know where that show is going to be. What they're trying to do with that show on the 23rd is come to Las Vegas. And they've asked the Nevada Athletic Commission to be able, they have a facility on their campus. They have a very big campus in Las Vegas, and they have a facility called Apex that has a 2,500-seat arena, and it's a full production studio. And they want to start putting the shows in there because it's locked down, and they control it. And it'll even be a better situation than what they have anywhere else. So they want to do that. Nevada has of yet for the 23rd given them permission to do that. But once Nevada does, you're going to see all the shows in Las Vegas with the exception of their Fight Island shows. They have they rented an island, and all we know about it, we don't know exactly where it is that it's in international waters. And the reason that Dana did that is that they have a lot of international fighters. They have 600 fighters under contract, a lot of them from outside the United States, and they can't get into the United States right now because of the travel restrictions, Clay. So what they're going to do is have this island in international water so that the international-based fighters who want to fight can go to that island, and they'll have fights down there. So they're building the infrastructure there. So they're going to, once we get past Jacksonville and Nevada's approved, and I do believe that this Nevada show will be approved, once that happens, you'll have all the domestic fights at Apex in Las Vegas, and then you'll have all the international fights down at Fight Island. They're building the infrastructure for that now, and it's not complete, but it's expected to be done, you know, the beginning of June.
I believe you're a Vegas guy, if I'm not mistaken, that you live there. Are you in Vegas right now?
Yeah, I am.
What does it feel like in Vegas?
Yeah, I did a story on this. I mean, it's starting to change, you know, but it is crazy. I mean, you know, I drove down the Strip one day because I was doing a story on, you know, Las Vegas during this pandemic. And I went from Sahara, where the Strip generally begins, all the way down to Russell Road. And I ran into one person who was a jogger, and he was literally on the road. and nobody else. I mean, and, you know, to see the casinos down, you know, the casinos haven't been closed since President Kennedy's funeral here. And they were open 9/11 and, you know, the whole nine yards. And so it's just a weird vibe to have. But we're starting to see more and more people, you know, kind of going out. The governor's eased restrictions, and we're in the new phase. But Las Vegas has taken a big hit from this, and it's going to take a long time for this economy to recover.
There's no doubt, and a lot of people don't think as much. You live there, of what a blue-collar town Las Vegas is. I mean, they think of the glitz and the glamour because people go there on vacation. But for the people who live in Las Vegas, it really is a blue-collar town, right? People get up and they go to work. And so much of it is associated with travel and tourism and leisure, and all those jobs are gone. So bringing the UFC back to Vegas and having there be some sense of normalcy there would probably be a small measure of help to the city and the state at large.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that it's going to help the people so much, because they're going to be closed venues, and so there's not going to be anybody out, and it's just going to be the same thing as if it was in Jacksonville or anywhere else from a Las Vegas standpoint. You know, I don't know that that is going to help, but I think what is going to help is just all these moves collectively. You know, there's talk that they may play the NBA playoffs here. You know, the MGM actually put together a proposal to have boxing, NHL, MLS, NBA, there was one other sport I'm drawing a blank on now, to have them all stay at the Mandalay Bay, the Delano, and down in that area, the Luxor, and kind of have like an Olympic Village type thing, and have it be open for the employees, for the athletes, and essential workers that would be supporting that, and then nobody else get in. And they were thinking about having that, so some people would have come back to work. I think that's kind of fallen through. They haven't been able to get everybody to agree to it. But as these things start to happen, I think that will be a lot better for the town. But it's going to take a while because we depend so heavily on the tourist trade.
And last question. Thanks for getting up with us again, at Kevin Ioli. How important is the return of sports in general? And how important was the UFC being back first on Saturday?
Yeah, you know, I wrote my column on post-fight on that on Saturday night, and I think it's hugely important because, look, you know, we're sitting here and, you know, you know, we understand why we have to social distance. We don't like it. We don't want to do it. But, you know, it's difficult, and there's nothing on TV to watch. You know, you don't have that live sports, and so many people are sitting there with cable news on, and, oh, my God, all you hear is about the, you know, about this. And so to have live sports to be able to watch and to give you a distraction and to get away from the fact that, you know, hey, you haven't paid your rent and you don't have all these other things for a couple of hours, it puts that in the background and gives you a little bit of fun. I think it's hugely important for the mental state of so many people. And, you know, I commend Dana White for that. I mean, the UFC did a good thing for a lot of people. And I think when the ratings come out, I believe we'll see the ratings tomorrow for ESPN. I think their prelims are going to have really big numbers.
I don't doubt it at all. Thanks for getting up early with us, my man. I agree with you. Big event there for Dana White to get done. And we appreciate you. Thanks, man.
You got it. Have a good one, Clay.
Yeah, that's Kevin Ioli.